Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Last year, the journalist McKay Coppins wanted to see if Rupert Murdoch's son, James, would talk to him. Now, Coppins had no idea what was going on in the family at the time, that there was this legal battle over the family trust. He just knew James had once been seen as a possible heir to his father's media empire and had since become something else, a dissident son.
I had this idea that James, as sort of the dissident son of the Murdoch empire, you know, the exiled scion, might have a story to tell. He had been inside the family business for 20 years. He had worked as an executive. He had, at various points, been groomed to be Rupert's successor. And then in 2020, he sort of out of nowhere resigned his seat on the board.
James Murdoch has resigned from the board of directors at News Corp.
News Corp owns the Wall Street Journal, known for its conservative editorial page.
Rupert Murdoch's youngest son said he was leaving because of disagreements on certain editorial content.
89-year-old Rupert Murdoch has counseled world leaders espousing his philosophy, but his son has moved to the left over the years.
News Corp publishes newspapers in the United States, Britain, and Australia.
And then that was it. And he never really explained himself. He never said what it was that led him to finally make this break with the family business. He never cited the exact editorial decisions he disagreed with. He just kind of went quiet. And so I had this kind of long shot idea that maybe he would be ready to unburden himself, to kind of finally tell the full story of what he'd seen inside the family business that so disillusioned him, and to talk about really what it's like to grow up a member of the Murdoch family. This like storied media family whose internal dysfunction has been the source of endless books and magazine articles and even, you know, movies, TV shows. What is it like to be in that family? So I kind of reached out to his press person on a lark, sort of expected that I wouldn't hear anything back, and then was surprised to find myself pretty soon after that initial email sitting across from him in a conference room in Manhattan as he told me what was happening in his family. And I didn't know when I first reached out to him that the Murdochs were in the midst of this really pitched, intense legal battle over the family trust and who would inherit the empire. But it turns out that when I reached out to him for an interview, this family was really melting down. And I think in some ways he felt like what his father was trying to do was liberating in a way. He had kind of kept his family's confidence for a long time and now felt ready to give his side of the story. And what happened from that point on was a year of conversations and interviews where he really opened up in ways that I was not expecting. I think that reporters often go into stories like this with a lack of curiosity. They kind of have a narrative that they want to flesh out. And so I didn't have that. I think I demonstrated some curiosity. I think also it helped that I didn't have much history with the Murdochs. There's like this whole cottage industry of journalists and authors and reporters who have made their careers out of documenting, chronicling the Murdochs. James actually kind of mockingly refers to the body of Murdoch literature as the canon. He really doesn't like a lot of those books and articles, and he doesn't see himself in them. I think he feels like he's often typecast as a certain kind of character, you know, the rebel, the contrarian. the black sheep of the family, and he feels like it's more nuanced than that. So the fact that I didn't have a lot of baggage, I had not really contributed much to the canon up to that point, I think actually worked in my favor, because he saw in me somebody who was coming to this story without a ton of preconceived notions. And so I think that's why he opened up to me. But like a lot of things in journalism, I also think it was luck. It was kind of being in the right place at the right time.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. McKay Coppin's story in The Atlantic is called Growing Up Murdoch. Over the course of a year, James Murdoch and his wife Catherine talked about the emotional toll of Rupert's ambition for power and his role in orchestrating all the internal rivalries in the family. James Murdoch was clearly fed up and disillusioned by all of it, but Coppins told us he was also conflicted. He was really mad at his father, but at times he was also protective of him.
This was one of the first things that I kind of latched onto and that made him seem like such a compelling subject, was that he really was sort of conflicted, right? Yeah. Like, he was clearly angry at his father and his oldest brother, Lachlan. And so you could tell that there was that anger that was kind of motivating him. But he also had this almost reflexive protectiveness of them. And I think this comes from a really natural place. I think a lot of us can understand having really complicated feelings about our family, but also wanting to protect them, right? Mm. But I think there's also something really specific about being a Murdoch, right? He had grown up in this family where there were certain ironclad rules that Rupert enforced. And one of them was that you never air the dirty laundry outside the family. You don't talk to reporters, especially reporters from outlets that we don't own. Mm-hmm. Rupert generally believes that any outlet that he doesn't own is the enemy, that it's out to get him, to destroy the companies, and that therefore you can't trust them. And so I could sense in my conversations with James some of those reflexes kicking in, right? Like, there he would start to kind of unburden himself or vent about something. And then when he sensed that I was a little too interested, he would pull back, right? Or if I asked a question that framed his father as kind of an antagonist or a villain in some ways, he would get quiet. And often his wife, Catherine, would start to speak up, right? His wife, Catherine, who he'd been married to for a long time, had been in this family herself for a long time. She had a lot of pretty strong opinions about how her husband was treated, how her father-in-law acted. But James would often kind of get quiet and nervous, and he would start tidying things up or doodling in his notebook. He's kind of an amateur artist. And I would sometimes catch glimpses of the legal pad that he had in front of him while we were talking and see that he had been like sketching a cat or writing my name in multiple different fonts. Or like you could tell that he was uncomfortable with this on some deep level that I found really compelling and also kind of tragic.
It's also interesting that James Murdoch is looking at his family like he would look from as a scholar, as an historian. You mentioned he likes to think of himself as the student of dynastic dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And we'll come to his thinking about a particular Roman emperor here in a moment, but it does seem like he is thinking about his family in historical terms or maybe literary terms, that they fit into some kind of literary trope or something.
I thought that was also really interesting. And I think that part of that is him processing his own kind of family pain, right? Like, I think his particular way of processing all this was to not personalize it, but almost to make it sort of academic, you know, to like make it a thing that he could study and find historical parallels to or literary touch points that helped him understand what was happening to his family, to understand how his father treated him, etc. But also he is kind of generally a really intellectually curious guy. He's very well read. I think in my home office, I have a stack of books that I accumulated over the course of our year together, because he would recommend something. And sometimes it would be, you know, like something very deliberately connected to what we were talking about. But sometimes it would be like, have you read Rudyard Kipling's book, Kim? And I'd be like, no. And then I'd have to go buy it and make sure I'd read it before we talked next, right? But he can't help but see these patterns in his family repeating over and over again. That was something that he realized. He said, you know, Tolstoy has that famous line at the beginning of Anna Karenina, all happy families are alike, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And he actually disagrees with that because he feels like when he looks at the history of families like his, wealthy families kind of wrecked by money and power and greed, he sort of sees the same patterns replaying over and over again. And after a while, he couldn't stop seeing them.
We have to say something about Succession, HBO Succession, for obvious reasons. But you mentioned in the piece that in your conversations with James and with Catherine, that the stories you mentioned started to have this kind of familiarity to them, like, as you put it, slightly altered forms of the series Succession. But it's more than that. Just talk a little bit about the connection here, because in some way, it's not just an idea that the HBO creators, well, it probably is, are forming their ideas for Succession based on this, but there's more of a connection there. Explain it. It's a really interesting connection here.
So there was this weird thing that would happen to me when I was started to interview him, where I would feel like some story he told me seemed really familiar. And I would try to place it, right? I'd be like, was that in that Michael Wolff biography of Rupert? Or was that in some Vanity Fair story I read from 10 years ago? And he would always say, no, I'm the only, you know, I've never told this story to anyone. And I'd realize that it was, oh, that was in an episode of Succession.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Succession's interplay with the family, though, is that the Murdochs in general are kind of obsessed with this show and were from the beginning. And actually, that's pretty understandable in some ways. Like, can you imagine if HBO made a like critically acclaimed drama about your family? You know, like it would be hard to look away, as uncomfortable as it was. James always claimed to me that he had never seen it. He watched the first episode. It was too painful. He couldn't watch anymore. But within the Murdoch family, it almost became this kind of parlor game to guess which member of the family was leaking to the writers of Succession.
Right.
James and Catherine were convinced that James's older sister, Liz, was talking to the writers. She actually works in Hollywood. Liz was adamant that she did not talk to the writers, but thought that her ex-husband had. It was kind of this whole thing in the family. Mm-hmm. I ended up, I should say, talking to Jesse Armstrong, who created the show, and he kind of laughed at it and said, I think there's a bit of a psychodrama around this whole thing, and insisted that there was no mole in the Murdoch family, that it was all based on kind of press reports. But what's interesting is that there was this kind of life imitating art, imitating life phenomenon that started to happen, where the Murdochs would kind of see things happening in Succession and assume that they were based on things that were being leaked by other members of the family, and then would therefore start to act as though what was happening in the show was resembling real life, right? And so, like, all the kind of on-air scheming almost fueled more real life scheming within the family and sowed distrust and paranoia within the family that in some ways I think led to this kind of breakup that's happening right now.
I mean, that's saying something, that the HBO series Succession, based loosely on the lives of the Murdoch family, actually impacted the lives of the Murdoch family. I mean, one of the things you write is that Rupert Murdoch is seeing Succession. He somehow becomes convinced that his real life kids are maneuvering against him based on the thing that he's seeing. And the fact that this show really defines where we are now with the family is kind of extraordinary.
It really is. And it's funny because early on, I sort of resisted the tropes of Succession. I had seen the show. I'd watched the whole show.
Yeah.
But then I was like, I'm going to very deliberately not rewatch the show while I'm working on the story because I didn't want the journalism to be kind of affected by this very well done show. It's very well written. It's really evocative from the score to the way it's shot and the characters. But I was like, I don't want that to seep into this. This is journalism. This is, nonfiction narrative. I want this to be its own thing. But it kind of became impossible to avoid Succession as a subject because it became clear that this fictionalized television show was affecting real world outcomes. And I guess the only thing to say about it is it's kind of perfect for a media family like the Murdochs, right? Like the fact that what is happening on TV screens ends up being a kind of key driver in their own internal family dynamics makes a certain amount of sense when you look at the Murdoch family as a whole and its history and its place in the world.
Well, congratulations for working through the Byzantine story that is the Murdoch family. Let's back into it as you do in the piece and just start with the Project Family Harmony. Tell us what that is, because I think that'll give us sort of a background to get started.
Right. So Project Family Harmony began in 2023, and it was basically the code name given to a kind of set of plans that were made by Rupert and Lachlan and some of their advisors and executives to figure out how to rewrite the Murdoch Family Trust in such a way that would concentrate full control of the empire with Lachlan once Rupert died. Mm-hmm. As the trust is currently written, once Rupert dies, control over all the companies is split four ways equally between Rupert's four oldest children. That's Prudence, Elizabeth, Lachlan, and James. Rupert, believing that his three other children were secretly plotting against Lachlan to essentially execute a coup against him and take over the companies once Rupert was gone, decided that he wanted to rewrite the terms of the trust to make sure that Lachlan had full control. The problem with that is that the trust was established as an irrevocable trust, which means that no changes to it could be made unless Rupert could prove to a probate commissioner that they were in the best interest of his children. So Project Family Harmony was essentially a euphemistic code name given to a plan to disenfranchise three of Rupert's children in favor of Lachlan. And it's important to say here why Rupert wanted Lachlan to have full control. Yeah. And it really does come down to kind of the political influence of the Murdoch Empire, right? The Murdoch Empire consists of a lot of things. It's HarperCollins, the book publisher. It's a collection of TV channels across Australia, Asia, and the US. But primarily, it's known in the US for Fox News and maybe to a lesser degree, the Wall Street Journal. But it is seen as a key element of the conservative media in America. And Fox News especially has wielded enormous influence over Republican politics as long as it's existed. And so Rupert believes that James and his sisters don't truly believe in the conservative mission of Fox News and these other outlets, that once Rupert dies, their plan is to kind of boot Lachlan from the corner office, take over these outlets, defang them, moderate them, maybe sell them off as pieces, and destroy Rupert's life work. That's how Rupert sees it.
The idea that Rupert thinks of his life's work as connected to a particular ideology is really interesting. It's not that he sees the dynasty as having, financial success. Like his worldview, his vision for the family business that he doesn't think James and his sisters are connected to is about ideology. Is that right?
Yeah. No, that's right. And this becomes very clear in some of the internal family communications that have come out in the discovery process of this lawsuit, which, by the way, is all supposed to be under seal, and none of this is supposed to be public, but a lot of it has leaked. The New York Times actually got a hold of 3,000 pages of documents from inside the lawsuit. I've obviously done my own reporting. But yes, it's very clear from these internal family communications that Rupert sees his project, his life's work, as being about providing a conservative counterpoint to what he considers to be the broadly liberal mainstream media in America, Europe, and Australia. I'll also say this, you know, James was not like, he didn't delude himself into thinking it was otherwise when he worked for Rupert. James, mm-hmm. it should be said, actually does have more moderate politics than his father and brother. He has been a major contributor to Democratic candidates, and he's supportive of climate change initiatives. That's one of his and Catherine's pet issues. And so they have a lot of problems with the kind of conservative politics espoused by places like Fox News. But if you ask James about this, he will say that it's always been nonsense, that this idea that he was going to come in and turn Fox News into MSNBC, right? Mm-hmm. His issue is that he feels like the way that Rupert runs these companies is unprofessional and reckless. And he thinks there could be a version of Fox News that still reports from a conservative perspective, still platforms conservative voices, but that has normal journalistic editorial guardrails. Yeah. And that it's as responsible as any other news outlet, and that he just feels like without an intervention, that's not going to happen. Rupert and Lachlan have shown no interest, in his view, in running the outlets that way.
We're going to come back to that. But I want to back up and ask, where does this idea about the, at least as Rupert Murdoch conceives it, the family business, the vision for the family business, his life's work being, you know, protecting the right flank in politics. Is that born of Rupert, or does that come from Rupert's father? Because you touch on the family mythology, Keith Arthur Murdoch, who also seems interested in planting a dynasty. I'm not sure if he has the same vision, but back up and talk about the family mythology. Talk about Rupert's father.
Yeah. So Keith Arthur Murdoch was a reporter, actually, during World War I when Australian soldiers were fighting in Gallipoli. And this might seem all a little esoteric to American listeners, but in Australia, Gallipoli is like a major part of the kind of national mythology. Yeah. You know, it's this campaign, a military campaign that's been a secret disaster where Australian soldiers are dying by the thousands. The charge is basically that the British military is using them as cannon fodder, but it's all being covered up, right? And nobody in Australia knows what's happening. They just know that a ton of people are dying. And Keith Arthur Murdoch actually goes to the front. And as a reporter, the deal he's made with the military is that they will allow him to the front, but only if he'll submit his report to military censors before it's published. Right. When he kind of sees what's going on in Gallipoli, decides to smuggle out his dispatch without giving it to the military censors, and writes this 8,000-word letter that circulates widely in Australia, sparks massive public outrage, changes the course of the Gallipoli campaign, and Keith becomes actually a pretty prominent national figure in his own right. He's like a hero. He ends up becoming a very prominent journalist in Australia, then a news executive. And when he dies in 1952, he leaves behind a newspaper to his 21-year-old son, Rupert, with the hopes of planting a family media dynasty. Rupert, who is actually in college when he inherits this newspaper, returns to Australia as soon as he can and just embarks on this sort of legendary conquest of the Australian media landscape. Very, very quickly starts gobbling up newspapers and then TV stations and reinventing these newspapers in a way that actually a lot of people now believe basically constituted the beginning of the modern tabloid. He just has this kind of innate sense for what will sell newspapers. And it's a mix of political scandal and sports and populist outrage. And by the time he's 40, Rupert is already the most powerful figure in Australia. he eventually will control two-thirds of the country's newspaper market and decides to start expanding internationally. And that's how he gets to Europe and then eventually to the U.S.
But when does he make the connection between success and politics, like having influence and wielding power? That was critical. It wasn't just that he was making money. He wanted to have influence in the process, it seems.
Yeah, I think that it was in London where Rupert sort of discovered that one of the great pleasures of press barondom is wielding political power, right? So he gets to Fleet Street and he buys a pair of popular British newspapers and then uses them to campaign for Margaret Thatcher, who is running for prime minister. She's obviously elected. He becomes a close ally of hers. And Thatcher actually clears kind of regulatory hurdles for Rupert to expand his British TV holdings in Britain. And I think that's where he sort of realizes, oh, there's more to this business than selling newspapers and making money. You can actually use the press to get political outcomes that will then help him to further expand his media empire.
McKay Coppins, he's a staff writer at The Atlantic. His story is called Growing Up Murdoch. It's in the April edition of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist McKay Coppins is back with us. This time, he's telling us about his reporting in The Atlantic on the Rupert Murdoch family. Coppins got Rupert's son James to open up about his father's media dynasty, which has been embroiled in this battle over succession, but also fractured by a deep ideological divide. And the piece is about what seems to be this shift in Murdoch's power and his influence, but it's also just juicy and gossipy. It's the real-life version of succession with all the betrayal and secret alliances that you'd expect. It's called Growing Up Murdoch. McKay, why is it so important to Rupert Murdoch to involve his family, to involve the kids? Because you describe this as his animating motivation.
It's a good question. This ended up becoming one of the key questions I was trying to answer for myself as I wrote the piece.
Because you would think he wouldn't care about the kids. I mean, he's successful or whatever, and they can do whatever they want. But that
right, to me, a normal way of associating your family life with your professional life, it would be, and I do this even with my own kids, right? I don't have nearly as much power or success as Rupert Murdoch, but I welcome them into kind of my professional world if they're interested. I tell them about the articles I'm working on, the books I'm working on. I bring them to events, right? Like Rupert, it was much more than that. He did all that, right? He would take his young kids on tours of the printing presses. He'd have them sit through dinners where he had various, dignitaries or politicians or media executives. Mm. But it was more than that because he wanted his empire from the very beginning to be a family business. He always envisioned leaving the company to his own kids and spent an enormous amount of time and energy trying to figure out which of his kids should be his successor. Why is that? I mean, it was a question that I had all the time. I've put it to James a few different times. I think that on some level, Rupert sort of felt like making this a family business is what was how he could extend his legacy into immortality. I think it was ultimately about his own ability to continue to exert influence even beyond the grave.
Let's talk a little bit about the family dynamic. I mean, the way you lay it out in the piece, let's talk about the sisters first. Prudence, you say, is the peacemaker. Liz is kind of the temperamental artist. Mm-hmm. James is kind of – and we'll talk more about this in a second, but he's sort of – he's typecast anyway. I think you put it this way, as the outsider, right? What's Lachlan?
Well, so Lachlan and James are born just 15 months apart. Yeah. Liz told me that they were treated almost like twins growing up. But Lachlan was the older one, and he was sort of always more self-consciously emulating his father. He wanted to make dad proud. He wanted to be what his dad wanted him to be. And I think that in the way that a lot of families sort of typecast the various kids, James ended up kind of defining his identity and personality almost in contrast to his older brothers. Mm. Because Lachlan was the golden boy, James was the contrarian. He was the kind of rebel. Mm. And James admits that he kind of leaned into that identity in some ways, right? He pierced his ear. He got tattoos. He bleached his hair. He would get in trouble at school. At the dinner table, he would often be the one kind of asking these like needling questions to his dad to try to exasperate him. Mm. He was always the one kind of making trouble in the family, right? And I think he would say that, like, as a teenage boy, that was kind of his right, you know? Like, yeah. A lot of people go through a phase like that. I think that in the eyes of his father, at least, and maybe everyone in the family, he sort of never outgrew it, right? And that can be a real danger in these stereotypes that we sometimes end up with in our families. Like, you end up almost feeling like you can't escape the family stereotype of you. And I think James felt that way to a certain extent.
I felt sad for James as a kid. And it's ironic that Rupert Murdoch is conceiving of the family business, needing almost to involve his kids in the business, and yet at the same time neglecting them, ignoring them. You mentioned James spending his childhood in this incredible apartment, penthouse suite, I guess it was, in New York. He has a butler, but dad's not anywhere around for a lot of the time. So I felt sad for James.
Yeah, no, I did too. There's a lot of pathos in this kind of like privileged, lonely life that James was leading as a kid. There's this really funny story where James once asked his mom, "Is daddy going deaf?" Right. And his mom said, "No, he's just not listening."
Yeah.
And I think that kind of was the dynamic, right? Like, it's not that Rupert was intentionally cold. Yeah. Rupert was just very distracted, kind of uninterested in his kids' lives unless they were taking an active interest in him and his work, right? By the time James is 16, Rupert and his mother have actually moved to Los Angeles. Right. And James spends his teenage years in this penthouse alone, basically, with a butler named George. He doesn't see his parents that often. He would go weeks at a time without seeing them. He would describe when his dad would come to New York, it felt like spotting a celebrity.
Well, he's forced into the family business, and he sort of goes along, but you can tell he falls asleep during a press conference when he's an intern at one of these newspapers in Australia, and people notice.
Yep, it ends up on the front page of a rival newspaper.
Yeah. Which says what? He goes along because he knows what's expected of him, but maybe not much in those days is going to be expected of him. And then fast forward to having this success. You write about how he's sent to Hong Kong to take over one of these satellite TV companies in Asia, and he kills it.
It surprised basically everyone, right? It certainly surprised his father.
Yeah.
It surprised a lot of the people in the News Corp board, because at this time, Lachlan is the one being groomed as the successor. He's the oldest son. He's the one who clearly wants it. James has sort of reluctantly been dragged into the family business, and he gets sent on what a lot of people describe as a suicide mission. And to everybody's surprise, turns around this satellite company within a couple of years. It's profitable. And James actually finds in this experience that he's not only good at running media businesses, he actually kind of likes it. He likes it more than he thought he would. And then, because he does so well, his dad sort of has no choice but to give him a promotion.
Well, he has this opening to sort of take over the running of the business, or part of it anyway, when Lachlan leaves in 2005. He gets fed up, goes back to Australia. this leaves an opening for James. Does he become the golden boy now?
It's complicated, right? Yeah. He definitely becomes the heir apparent at right. this point. Lachlan effectively taking himself out of the running because he's been squabbling with Rupert's lieutenants, like including Roger Ailes, who's running Fox News. He feels like his dad doesn't really have his back, gets fed up with the whole thing, quits and moves back to Australia. Now it's James. And the problem with this arrangement is that James is the obvious successor at this point.
Yeah.
He's well-liked, generally admired within the company. He clearly has some talent, but he has a very different kind of approach and worldview from his father. Mm-hmm. Not only politically, he does have different politics from his father, but he also has a totally different approach to running these companies, where Rupert is sort of, you know, reckless and very excited to take big risks and sees himself as sort of like a pirate or a gambler and surrounds himself with executives who are like that as well. James is much more meticulous and he wants to create healthy corporate culture, and he immerses himself in the language of kind of MBA schools. Mm. And the people he surrounds himself with are much more in that mold. And Rupert hates that.
Yeah.
It totally rubs him the wrong way, because Rupert, the whole mythology of the Murdoch empire is that they're almost kind of like the evil empire. That he has built this thing that everyone else in the media hates. And he's done it by defying expectations and breaking rules. And he almost delights in his own villainy. The fact that his son seems to want to be liked by the people that hate Rupert really bothers him. And so even though he makes James his kind of next in line and promotes him again, he eventually is running all of the company's operations in Asia and Europe, there is this clear wedge between them that is only really exacerbated as James becomes more influential and more successful.
There's this kind of weird thing that happens in 2010. Rupert Murdoch invites his kids to this retreat back home in Australia. It's a family counseling retreat. Like, on one hand, you want to think, oh, dad wants to get us together so we get along. Mm-hmm. But it just turns out to be, at least James thinks, a form of dad just is trying another way to manipulate all of us. Talk about this retreat.
Well, first of all, I should say, if listeners who watch Succession, their ears are perking up, it's because totally. This was an episode in the first season of Succession.
Right.
Yeah, so all the kids, all the adult children get invited to Australia for this family retreat. And it's really out of character for Rupert, we should just say.
Yeah.
Rupert is not a big believer in therapy, at least as far as James knows. This is a new interest of his. And the Murdochs are not a heavily therapized family. They've never been through family counseling before. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of already kind of deep issues within the family. But James is pretty skeptical of the whole enterprise. And at the beginning of the retreat, James kind of sits down with the therapist who's meeting with each of the family members individually before they begin. And he basically just says straight up, look, there's some stuff that you don't need to pick at. Nothing good is going to come of it.
Yeah.
And the therapist ignores that advice. And as soon as the family is reconvened, according to James at least, the whole session devolves into kind of gaslighting and recriminations and posturing. And everyone has their own story that they're spinning to try to garner strategic sympathy and advance their own agendas. Catherine told me that she thought the shrink was outmatched by the Murdochs and their capacity for manipulation. But what James told me is that everyone was more alienated from each other by the end of it. What he didn't know at the time, and only later came to realize after this kind of legal situation that the Murdochs are in surfaced all these internal family communications, was that Rupert at this point was worried about James's growing influence in the company. Mm. And apparently, so were some of James's siblings. They didn't like how their little brother was kind of wielding his own power, seemed increasingly independent from Rupert. Maybe there was a little bit of resentment there, seeing their little brother kind of act like the heir apparent, and they wanted him to be reined in. And apparently, at least according to James, this whole family counseling situation was really a pretense for the family to come together and stage sort of an intervention with James and tell him he needed to kind of slow down and start listening to his dad.
One of the things you also mentioned is that seeing those texts and emails and during that litigation kind of freed James to talk, and it may have impacted his decision to talk to you.
I do think that's true. I think that seeing the way that his dad in particular talked about him to his siblings behind his back over many, many years, I think that was sort of very painful, but also liberating. I think also he came to realize that as much as he'd been told, you never talk to reporters, you never air the family's dirty laundry, et cetera, some of the communications that came out in Discovery strongly suggest that it was actually Rupert's camp who had planted many of the stories over the years about the family. And when he realized that his own father and brother were not following these supposedly ironclad family rules, he kind of wondered why he should have to.
Say something about how Lachlan comes back into the picture. He becomes the golden boy again. How does that happen?
Well, in 2015, James is back in New York being groomed to take over as CEO. And one day at a lunch with the COO of the company, Lachlan is there and is kind of blindsided with the news that Lachlan is returning to the US, returning to the company, and that he's actually going to take over and that James is going to report to him. As you can imagine, James is kind of completely stunned by this news. He had no idea that Rupert was kind of secretly back channeling with his older brother to try to get him to come back. Eventually, after James threatens to quit, a new arrangement is made wherein Lachlan and James will effectively run the companies together, with James as CEO and Lachlan as executive chairman. And for the next several years, they try to basically run the family business as co-leaders, and it does not exactly go smoothly.
McKay Coppins. His profile of James Murdoch is featured in the April issue of The Atlantic. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with McKay Coppins about his story in The Atlantic, about the unraveling of the Murdoch family. The story is called Growing Up Murdoch. I think this gets us to one of the really critical questions in the piece. People should read your story, because I'll jump over and get to the point where Rupert Murdoch, as people probably already know, and his son Lachlan lose that trial over the public trust. And what seems to be, to me anyway, one of the biggest questions of the story then is, okay, so James has won, or at least in the sense that this trust will prevail. And as you write, what would the Murdochs' conservative news outlets look like if James had his way? So what do you think? Because I think what's interesting is you've got all of these incentives that James still has to sort of contend with. He is a moderate, but he also knows if he's going to make Fox News, let's say, or any of these other outlets successful, he is going to have to sort of rework his own principles, because they don't always align with that.
Well, so what James would say to this is that Fox News doesn't need to be a non-conservative outlet to be a well-run, responsible media outlet. right? He says the reforms that he wants to see at Fox and at throughout the companies really have to do with corporate governance and editorial governance, right? Yeah. Fox News could still be a conservative news outlet without, for example, giving a platform to kind of quack doctors spreading medical misinformation during a pandemic, or platforming conspiracy theorists who say that the 2020 election was stolen, which it clearly wasn't, right? Mm-hmm. He has this just strong belief that actually it wouldn't be contrary to his principles to provide a responsible, reality-grounded conservative news outlet, that in fact, that's what our politics needs, right? Mm-hmm. There's always going to be a conservative political coalition in this country. Why not provide media for it that is making their understanding of the world better instead of kind of corrupting their coalition with these conspiracy theories and lies?
But Catherine said something really intriguing to you. Mm-hmm. She said she wasn't sure if Fox News could be reformed. And this is how she put it. She says, it doesn't have a clear purpose in the ecosystem anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What did she mean by that?
I don't want to parse it too much because she didn't elaborate beyond that. But she seemed to believe that Fox News has gotten past the point where it's redeemable, that it has so fully become kind of an organ of pro-Trump propaganda without any sort of animating set of conservative ideas, that the only role that it serves is to support this one guy, Donald Trump, right? Now, look, she isn't the one who would be making these decisions, but it to me, it did suggest that this is an active question that the couple has considered when they're thinking about the future.
Let me read something from your piece. You write this. For now, James is left struggling to answer the question he found himself asking in the courtroom. How did we let it come to this? How did he?
One of the many literary allusions that he made throughout our interview was to a book called Memoirs of Hadrian.
Yeah.
And it's a 1951 novel about Hadrian, who is this second century emperor of Rome. So in this passage, Hadrian is with his predecessor, who is, in his own words, refusing to face his end. He's basically on his deathbed. And Hadrian pities him. It says, "We were too different for him to find in me what most people who have wielded total authority seek desperately on their deathbeds, a docile successor pledged in advance to the same methods and even to the same errors." For James, I think reading that passage was this sort of epiphany for him, because he realized that at some really fundamental level, Rupert saw his children as kind of nodes of immortality. They were reflections of himself, and that's it. And the reason that Rupert had always favored Lachlan over James actually had very little to do with James or Lachlan as people. It had to do with the fact that Rupert believed Lachlan would do exactly what he would do if he were there. And he wanted a successor who would extend his reach beyond the grave, give him some sense of immortality, make the same decisions, even the same mistakes. I think that this is the original sin of the Murdoch family. And frankly, it's the original sin of a lot of families like this. When a parent or patriarch starts to see their kids primarily as pawns in their own chess game or vehicles for dynastic ambition or reflections of themselves and their legacy and not as their own people, it poisons the family dynamic in some way. I think the reason the family has ended up in this place is because at the end of the day, the leader of the family, the patriarch of the family, made his own legacy and his own empire building the priority over his own relationships with his family. And in the end, he lost his family as a result.
Well, Rupert Murdoch is 94. He's on his fifth wife. Any sense of what is going to happen now, can you tell, based on your reporting over the last year?
You know, there are all kinds of rumors circulating constantly that maybe Rupert will buy out James and his sisters before he dies and just give all the shares to Lachlan. That's a possibility. It's a possibility that he'll continue to pursue other legal remedies to the problem as he sees it. This current case is currently under appeal, and so there, it's possible that there will be more steps in the family drama. I think what's really tragic here is that Rupert will die one day, probably sooner rather than later. And unless something dramatic changes between now and then, his family will be basically wrecked when he dies, right? They'll all show up at the funeral, but it'll be kind of a collection of estranged people and ex-wives and all of them kind of uttering niceties to each other. But this will not be a united family grieving their beloved father together. It will really highlight just how far this family has fallen. And I think that's more than anything what makes James really sad.
McKay Coppins, thank you very much.
Thank you.
McKay Coppins, he's a staff writer at The Atlantic. His story is called Growing Up Murdoch. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.